welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn. It's the 9th of June 2014 and this is episode 185 of the podcast. And you can probably hear in my voice, I have been a bit sick the last few days. I've had nearly 4 days out of action, and for me that is just torture. I'm a terrible patient, and my husband has been wonderful, but I tell you what, I'm glad to get back to work. But it does give one some perspective. I will come back to that in a minute. But today I have an interview with Audible approved professional audiobook narrator Rosalind Ashford, who narrated my supernatural suspense thriller Desecration. And on that, I am still playing with what genre I put that book into. The sequel Delirium will be out soon, so having more books will probably help. But BookBub put it into supernatural suspense recently, and it did really well. Got up to around number 300 in the store. Sold pretty well. So that was quite interesting for me. And there is a psychic character in the book. So anyway, that was quite an interesting change. And anyway, in the interview, Rosalind and I talk about the intimate relationship between the author and narrator and the nature of the ACX style collaboration, as well as some more details about the actual work of a narrator. And Rosalind's got a very lovely British accent. She can do a lot of accents, but her normal voice is a beautiful British accent. So I think you will enjoy that. She, like Simon Whistler from the Rocking Self-Publishing podcast, these people who do audiobooks just have beautiful voices. Anyway, so in terms of the perspective, I've been thinking about these at the Amazon and Hachette negotiations, which have seemed to have brought this sort of emotional outpouring on the web. I mean, we've obviously seen big names like James Patterson, Malcolm Gladwell, John Green, who did The Fault in Our Stars, which is an amazing book, all coming out and, you know, calling Amazon evil. And then, you know, we've had Joe Comrath and Hugh Howie and, you know, lots of people on the other side. And I've worked at some very big corporates, including mining companies, where the negotiations over things like the price of coal to sell to China, you know, the sort of massive big negotiations worth billions and billions of dollars. And not that I was involved in them, but I've worked at companies where, you know, negotiations are just a part of business. And so I've just been kind of amazed at the how emotional this has got, given that Amazon and Hachette are both very large companies. And of course, authors are stuck in the middle. But at the end of the day, authors don't have any power in this case. And that's what I keep thinking about, is what is the balance of power in this situation, in the Amazon Hachette situation? And what is the balance of power for us as indies, as for me personally, as an entrepreneur making my living online, for you, where are the power balances that we work in? One of the reasons I don't pitch, and really have never pitched, you know, briefly I have done a little bit of pitching, but generally people come to me now because I hate pitching. It's because of that balance of power. It's like, I don't want to beg anyone for anything. I want to attract people to want to work with me. And I feel like this balance of power issue with Hachette and Amazon, I'm looking at it going, how can Hachette have allowed Amazon to gain such control? Or how have the publishing industry, you know, they've had ample time to put stuff in place to gain, you know, market share through selling in a different way. And so I just can't see how they've got the power in this negotiation at all. And then if you take it down a level, how can the author, these very big name authors who you'd think have a lot of power, they're, one of the reasons they're going a bit nuts is because they don't have any and they don't have any choice in this matter. And if Amazon and Hachette, you know, if it all breaks down and Amazon just go, all right, then we won't sell your books, Hachette will have to almost start again. What I think will happen is, I think everyone's, this is making everyone think. Now, I love Amazon as much as any indie author. You know, I would not be running my business as profitably without Amazon. And I love KDP and ACX, and, you know, we're all very happy with them. But we do have to think about this control issue, and how can we allow anyone to have so much control over our business? So we should definitely be working with partners for mutual gain. And I will absolutely continue with Amazon and KDP and, you know, all of that. But we have to think about the next. And I'm 40 next year. So for me, I'm hoping it will be another 40 to 50 years that I'm doing this. And, you know, when you're lying in bed feeling like crap, you know, thinking our health is so important, but control is also important. So the next thing I'm thinking about, as well as continuing to partner with Amazon, Kobo, iBooks, Nook, Smashwords, other partners, ACX, all of the above, is thinking about direct sales for my books. And not to go exclusively direct, but to think about that as another channel. So I will be investigating that some more. It's something I've been thinking about for a while, but this whole Amazon Hachette thing is making me go, yeah, okay. So I start it now and I make, you know, a little bit of money direct, and over time it grows. And that's in the same way as our email list is so important, because it's the only thing we have. I think that selling direct from a website is also going to become more and more important as time goes by. So those are some of my thoughts as I've been lying on my sick bed. I've been doing a lot of reading, which has been fun. Anyway, also coming up, so I've got a very busy few months, but coming up in the next few weeks, I've already recorded a couple of these interviews and I'm basically getting everything, all my ducks in a row as such. I have three particularly exciting interviews coming up. First of all, Bob Mayer, who is perhaps the godfather of indie, very experienced businessman, author of over 50 books, you know, indie guru, doesn't like to be called a guru. But anyway, Bob Mayer will be next. Then Stephen Pressfield, who wrote The War of Art and Turning Pro, and one of my mentors in inverted commas. His books are the only books I have in ebook, print book, and audiobook. And I reread Turning Pro pretty regularly because it helps me focus on, you know, what I want for my life. Anyway, in Stephen's interview, we talk about our mutual love of Israel and his new book, The Lion's Gate, which is about the Six-Day War. He also kicks my butt about self-doubt and other manifestations of resistance. So that's coming up too. And then also David Morrell, author of over 35 thrillers and bazillions of short stories, essays and other things. He's got a book out for authors called The Successful Novelist. Oh, The Successful Writer, that's terrible. But most well known for First Blood, which became Rambo, the Rambo franchise. And we're going to be talking about what David's learned over 40 years of publishing, and also particularly the adaptation of books to film and what to watch out for there, because that's so interesting. I am scheduling all this in advance as I'm off to Barcelona for a research trip, and then the Lake District for holiday, and then I'm in New York for Thriller Fest. So if you're going to Thriller Fest, please say hi or email me, and we'll hopefully meet up and have a drink or something, doing some kind of tweet up, I'm sure. I'll also be in Toronto end of July for my brother's wedding, and I'll be visiting the Kobo offices in Toronto. So if you are an author in or around Toronto, there will probably be something you can come along to, and I'm just sorting out those details. So a busy, busy few months, although I am working, promise. It's quite weird because I feel like the beginning of the year went... I felt like I was getting nothing done, but it seems like I've got a whole load of things to publish right now, and I'm just publishing things because we've got the German Pentecost has come out, and there's a very big blog post coming out this week on that. The print edition's coming soon. Spanish version of Pentecost will also be ready soon, as well as the German Desecration. All of these are kind of coming in July. I've also finished a significant rewrite of Delirium based on some really helpful feedback from my editor, and that will be going to the proofreader and all of that, and then will also be out in July. And the Barcelona trip is the start of Inquisition, which is the next full-length Arcane novel. So yeah, all kinds. Oh, I'm also still working on the Business of Being an Author book, and writing it is really helping me work out the kinks in my own business, which is why it's kind of a slower process. So hopefully that will be out in August or September. So busy, busy, busy. I hope your writing time is going well at the moment. Okay. So we'll get into the interview, but first, the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'm going to talk about them a bit today. Basically, you can publish direct to Kobo devices and apps through kobo.com/writinglife, and it's a really easy interface to use with some great features, including price promotion scheduling and free pricing, both of which enable you to use those marketing tools to get some attention on your book. I also particularly like the reporting function on the author portal, which has a lovely map with circles of different sizes that represent your sales around the world. And one of my little pleasures is to go in there and mouse over the little dots and see if I can guess which countries the dots are over. So this is a good help for your geography lessons. And I've talked before about Burkina Faso, but I can now see I've sold books in Kazakhstan, Qatar, Colombia and Iceland, as well as all the usual suspects. And for someone like me obsessed with global reach, that's exciting. Of course, my main sales are Canada, USA, UK, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Singapore and Germany. But Kobo sells in 190 countries. So one of my little personal goals, of course, is to sell a book in every country possible, keeping an eye on that. And while not the size of Amazon sales, my Kobo income definitely pays some bills. And like going direct to iBooks and Nook, I believe the benefits of the extra metadata, the relationships with the Kobo team and the specific tools like the pricing that I mentioned are worth the hassle of publishing on multiple platforms. So for me right now in June 2014, I published direct on Amazon, Kobo, iBooks and Nook through Nook Press. And I'm happy with all of that. I still have Google Play to work out. We have time, people, we have time. Okay, so that's Kobo Writing, kobo.com/writinglife, or you can check out the Kobo Writing Life blog as well, where there's lots of interviews and stuff there too to help you maximise your Kobo sales. Okay, let's get into the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with Rosalind Ashford. Hi Rosalind.
Hello Joanna. Welcome to New York.
I'm so excited to be talking to you. And just as an introduction for everyone else, Rosalind is an actor, a voice artist, and an Audible approved audiobook narrator. She recently narrated my thriller Desecration, and which is available now on Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. So today we're talking all about audiobooks, which is such an exciting topic because the world is exploding. But let's start. Rosalind, tell us just a bit more about you and your background as a voice talent and narrator.
Well, back when the earth was cooling, I took dramatic arts in college and university and then moved to this country, to New York. I really started with theatre, but I've done film and TV. And then I just fell into radio and voice work. And I actually narrated my first book on radio for Books for the Blind back in, dare I say, 1980. So I've been reading books aloud for a few years. I took a break and did other things with my life and then came back into the business about 3 years ago, I think it is now. I had continued to do voice work, commercials, radio, TV, e-learning courses. And now that everything is digital, it really doesn't matter where you're located. So I do work for the European market. I do work for you and you're in London. Authors that could be anywhere in the world. So my background is extensive. And I have to say that narrating audiobooks is perhaps the most challenging of all the types of performing I've done. It's also the most rewarding.
Right. Well, we're going to come back to that in a minute. But before we do, tell us a bit more. Like 3 years ago, you mentioned there when I guess MP3s had really gone mainstream and digital media and stuff. What is the market for audiobooks like? And do you perceive that it's growing? Is it a rising market?
I think it's going to be huge. If you think about it, storytelling, which is basically what narrators do, has predated the written word. Cavemen were telling stories to each other, one presumes. So I think we're coming full circle. There's still something of a stigma attached to people listening to books versus reading books. There was always that belief that it was meant for the visually impaired or people who don't read well. But I think that's changing, perhaps because storytelling will never go out of fashion. Everybody loves to be told a good story. And also because these days we multitask to the point where we're ironing and we can listen to a book. We couldn't iron and read a book. We work out and listen to books. And I'm astonished when I'm in the subway in New York or the tube in London, how many people have their earplugs in. And I wonder how many are listening to music and how many are listening to books. And I think that in answer to your question, it is a hugely developing market. And I think it's going to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and I think the rise in podcasts as well also demonstrates the rise in audio in general. And there's some crazy statistic, like in America, people spend 90 minutes a day commuting, you know, the average person. And you get bored with just the radio or just music all the time, you know, so listening to books, podcasts, that type of thing. It's brilliant. So, no, I'm very excited. So tell us a bit more. What is the actual, you know, what do you do as a narrator? Like, what is the process? It's not just reading, is it? There's a hell of a lot more involved.
No, it's not. It's when people say to me, oh, I like to read, I could do that. I equate it to being given a paintbrush. I could hold a paintbrush, but I wouldn't be able to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And I wouldn't be able to paint your portrait. What's involved? Well, certainly the ability to read and to have the imagination to make the written word come alive. It's a combination, I think, of skill with talent, and there's a huge learning curve. So what's involved? Well, certainly to have a nice voice, one that doesn't grate, and there's all manner of studies that show that a certain range of voice is more pleasing than another range of voice. But reading is really only the beginning, because when I'm faced with a script, first of all, a manuscript, I'm going to read it through, because the worst thing that can happen is you start a book without having read that in the final chapter it's revealed that the hero has a lisp. You've just read the whole book with no lisp. So it behooves one to read the book. And as I read, I can almost hear the characters in my mind. So by the end of a book, I've got a really good fleshed out feel for how I'm going to translate what's on the page out of my mouth, and so then to your ears. Mm. So there's the reading part of it. There's the acting part of it. And actually, as I said before, it is probably one of the most challenging acting gigs I've ever done. And I, just for fun, I threw together a list of characters that I've portrayed in the last few books. And so I'll read this to you.
Yeah.
One book I had started in the first 65 pages, there were 32 named characters. So I had to come up in the first 65 pages with 32 individuals who sounded different. Mm. So that was a challenge. Then I made a list of who I've been in my narrating career. So I've been aristocratic, middle class, working class, Scottish, Welsh, Irish, Northern, Southern, Cornish, Kentish, a Cockney, a Brummie, a Geordie, a Liverpudlian, an East Ender, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, Russian, American, Southern American, American Indian, old, young, middle-aged, a child, a baby, male, female, kind, evil, alive, dead, a troll, a talking parrot, yes, a parrot, a tortoise, a horse, a caterpillar, a mouse, and that was all before lunch. So what other career gives me the opportunity to do all of that?
Mm.
It's great fun.
Yeah.
As I said, there is a learning curve, because not only is there all of that that's in the manuscript, and my job is to bring your words to life, but there's also a technical learning curve to master. And especially if you are acting as both narrator and producer.
Yes. Tell us about that bit, because you've kind of gone there into now you've spoken it, you've acted the book, and then you actually have to produce a file.
Yes, because when I'm sitting in front of a mic, I can hear my tummy rumble just before lunch. I can hear the trucks going by if they're particularly noisy. I stumble over a word. The skills involved with narration itself require that you learn breath control, of course, and also stamina, because at any given time you might sit in front of the mic for 5 hours. But once that's on tape, so to speak, or digitally on the computer, you have to make it listenable. You, as a listener, don't want to hear me or my chair squeaking or whatever. So then the next step is to edit the raw audio. And that is a skill. And I'm no engineer, and audio engineers go and get degrees in that. And certainly that's not what I do best. But I, by necessity, have had to learn some basics for editing. So you take that raw audio and you cut and paste and tweak with software that's now, of course, all digital. And then you have a much more refined file. But then you have to QC, quality control, and proof it against the manuscript. Because in the space of a given hour or so, you can miss a word. Your brain sort of is ahead of your mouth. So a narrator may very well stumble over a word or mispronounce a word or just transpose, and some of them are quite funny, quite rude too. But all of that has to be corrected or cut out or re-recorded. So that's the editing and that's the QC part. Then the whole file has to be mastered technically to suit the medium, which is, of course, digital, online, through Audible, iTunes, Amazon, and so forth. So that's a sort of a very short idea of what's involved.
Yeah. And tell people, like, how long is that editing process compared to the finished, like, per finished hour, how long does it take?
Well, if you're a beginner, one finished hour can take you, if you do it right and you do it carefully, as much as 10, 12 hours. As one becomes more proficient at the editing and the QC, the proofing and so forth, industry standards are usually around one finished hour will take you about 4 hours. Just an editor may take 2.5 hours. The QCer obviously has to listen to it as well. And if you're a one-man show, you're doing all of these things. Mm. So for every hour, I probably spend at this point, having done many, probably 6 hours. And as an Audible approved narrator and producer, there is a high standard to meet. Mm. And it's challenging.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I wanted you to tell people that, because I think people don't realize, you know, especially like I'm a podcaster but I just do one take. I rarely do much editing. It still takes me probably 3 hours in total to do a podcast because of the recording and the editing and the research and everything. And yet I'm just amazed at the work that goes into an audiobook. So I'm glad you talked about that. Another subsequent question. You know, you talked about all these different characters. Do you like write little notes down or something, so you go, okay, this is Bob sounds like this, and you know, Joan sounds like this? How do you remember that as you're reading?
Well, I'm old school, so I started with paper in the booth, but of course paper makes a noise when I turn the page. So when I started with paper, I would literally print out the manuscript, invest in every colored highlighter there is, and highlight those lines that are spoken by a specific character. Then I would have a crib sheet. And I'm saying this in the past tense because as I've become busier, I don't have the time to highlight. So this is what I used to do. Mm. I would highlight that written word in pink for the heroine, blue for the hero, purple for the evil man, the villain, and so on and so forth. And I'd have a crib sheet of whose color was what character. And I visually imagine that character. And oftentimes I will take a famous person as my template for that character. So it might be Prince Charles, this character. And I'm picturing in my mind as I'm reading his lines, Prince Charles. And that translates somehow from there to there, one hopes. And it's on paper. Now, that was what I used to do. These days, because of technology, that wonderful thing, the iPad, enables me to put that in my booth. It's totally silent, so there's no rustling of pages and there's no whirring of a computer. I can read the manuscript off my iPad, and I can even mark it up with certain apps if I wanted to have pink or blue or green or purple for that particular character. I can also add notes. So how does my brain translate what I read to what comes out of my mouth? I have no idea.
No.
It's one of those wonderful mysteries of acting that somehow, one hopes again, what I'm imagining is being translated into what you're hearing. Mm. So,
and which,
fascinating.
Which bit do you enjoy? I mean, I imagine, well, but which bit do you enjoy of all of that process? Like, what's the most fun and what do you like not really look forward to?
Well, I'm not an audio engineer. So the editing, I love to hear the finished thing done right, where breaths aren't so noticeable that they take the listener out of the moment. I love to hear the pacing just right. But the doing of it is not my most favorite thing. So
yeah.
If I have a large production queue in place, I actually will hire and outsource skills such as editing and QC proofing to the ones who do it better than I and do it faster than I. My favorite thing is actually the recording, because as an actor, I lose myself in the moment, and I'm sometimes quite astonished at how my mind puts me there. And actually, I will relate that to your book in particular. There is a chapter in your book, which in the finished audiobook is actually 15 minutes long. I took an hour and a half to just read that, because it was so emotionally charged and I was so invested in those characters that I couldn't read. I was as upset as the main character is in that chapter. I literally was crying, and I'm thinking, oh, for goodness sake, Rosalind. And the tears are streaming down my face, and you try reading when you're crying and it doesn't work. And whilst I hope that that investment as an actor is heard by the listener, There is a practical standard that as a reader I must meet. So I have to step back sometimes from that emotional investment and remember what my job is. It's to put the listener in the moment.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I must admit, I was crying when I wrote the scene.
I can imagine. And if you're listening to this, please read this book. I've done a lot of books with many more in the production queue to follow. And it's rare, I must say, to stumble upon something that speaks to one so vividly. I'm not a painter and I'm not a writer, but I am a reader, and I absolutely love Desecration. I cannot wait to learn more about Jamie and Blake. I really can't.
Oh, you're a sweetheart. You really are.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious.
Well, it's a good point, because I mean, we mentioned one scene which is pretty emotional, but the Desecration, some people have emailed me and said it's very confronting. It's definitely got an edge of a lot of very dark stuff, you know, body modification, corpse art, some quite gruesome stuff. And I, you know, I said to you before we started recording, you know, I feel like we're quite intimate, because you've seen inside my mind, and I feel like my fiction gives away so much of what's in me. So what do you think about this kind of relationship between the author and the narrator? And, you know, how do you, I guess, bring yourself into the mix? Because it's your voice too, in the end. My author voice, your voice.
Yes. Intimacy is actually, I think, the key. I get into your mind, and I think that that really illustrates the need to find the right narrator for the right book. And I'm not right for every book, just as any other actor is not right for every part. But I think there's something magical when the narrator just relates to the written word and the author hears what they had heard in their own minds. So it's intimate. It's hard work, isn't it? You and I were sending files back and forth and notes and so forth. And it's a very intimate, short, intense relationship between the author and the narrator. And I think there's a level of respect that needs to be addressed. To micromanage from either the author's point of view or the narrator's point of view, I think, is a mistake. The author writes and should leave the narrator to the narrator who narrates. To try to micromanage up from either end, I mean, maybe there's a sentence construction that I find a little awkward. It's my job to make it not sound awkward. And I think it's the author's job not to tell the narrator that that bit wasn't the way he or she heard it. because the magic is in the entirety, in its finished product. And it's a risky relationship, isn't it? Because you're so emotionally invested in your words, and I'm so emotionally invested in my voice that we have to develop that sense of respect for each other's expertise. And it's a fascinating relationship, and it doesn't always work,
and that's a really good point. And I think people need to realize this is not just a case of, you know, here's my book, you read it, you know, that's it. There is real risk. Let's just talk about the financial risk too, because we're on ACX, we're doing a 50-50 royalty split, so you know, you're invested in that and so am I, you know, but you've done all this work without guarantee of getting paid. So how does, you know, an experienced narrator like yourself pick projects that you're willing to do a 50-50 royalty split on?
It's a tricky balance. I do this full time, so I have bills I must pay, and I must pay them from what I do. So actually I'm fairly new to ACX because I had been narrating books as a narrator for publishing houses and major production houses in New York long before I got onto ACX and became the one-man show. So I was being paid by the hour, finished hour usually, by people who hired me as strictly a narrator. When it comes to the royalty deal on ACX, I think if you're a beginning narrator, it's a wonderful way to get some work behind you, to do work without an investment on the part of the author and without the expectation that if you're being paid, you should know what you're doing. I mean, everybody has to learn. And sometimes authors are new to audios, books, and narrators are new to narrating, even though they may be actors, they may be whatever. So I think the royalty share deal is a very fine introductory way to become a narrator. And ACX has really cornered the market on that introduction between independent authors, rights holders, and available actors, narrators. You and I would never have met had it not been for ACX. In terms of ACX for an experienced narrator, I'm very circumspect about the royalty share deals I do. The book has to, first of all, speak to me. It has to be well written. It has to be, I'm a reader. I want to feel like I want to know what's going to happen next. It's not a chore, and it mustn't ever be a chore, whether you're paid or whether you're on a royalty share deal. But because this is what I do for a living, it's a more of a risk for me to take on a project that I can't believe in and not be paid to do it. Because the payment aspect requires an investment of marketing when it's a royalty share deal. And it's not, if I'm going to take that royalty share deal, it behooves me to help with the marketing. And so if you're being paid by the per finished hour as a narrator, I don't consider necessarily that it's such an important part of my job to market that title because I've been paid for my role. I do feel a responsibility with royalty share deals to help in the marketing of them, which is why we're doing this, of course. So I think, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's important because, for example, I've put up a German version of one of my other books, Pentecost, onto ACX. And unsurprisingly, I think I've had nobody pitching for it. Now, I think that's partly because German's a new language for ACX and that. But it's interesting, you know, I've got no platform in the German market. I've got nothing. And I won't be surprised if nobody wants to read it because, that you know, there's got to be something else, you know, I mean, you've got to be able to prove that you're a worthwhile investment. And yes. I feel, it's funny, I feel very, and I work with translators as well, I feel very responsible for making this a successful endeavor for both of us, so that, you know, we've got the 7-year license with ACX. Within the 7 years, we should both make more money than we would have done if I'd have just paid you up front, you know, so that I feel like this is a true collaboration.
Indeed.
And that's a great thing. You know, it's a brilliant thing about this online world.
Well, I did do a lot of research when I made the decision to audition for your book. Yeah. I checked you out. I Googled you. I looked at your websites. I saw your previous books. I checked them out on Amazon. So I think it behooves the narrator to know what they're getting into and not just take anything. Perhaps if you're trying to establish a body of work, that you're more likely to take a royalty project than you are being able to get a per finished hour project. But I think that the principles are the same regardless. You have a responsibility, you do and I do, to make this successful. But I can't wait for the rest in the series. And I'm so thrilled that you've made this a series, because I think originally you only had this one and the next book with those characters.
I did. You're absolutely right. I really thought it would only be two or even one, a standalone. But no, there will be more. And I don't know if I've told you this. So the next one's going to be called Delirium, which is out, which hopefully will be out soon. And the next, and the one after that will be called Deviance.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, and I know you do some romantic narration, don't you, with a bit of sex in?
Oh yes. Yes. Sometimes if I'm hired by one of the production houses, I do not have the opportunity to review the manuscript prior to accepting or being given the job. When I'm rich and famous, perhaps I'll have more control over what I say yes or no to. But because I'm British, and because I'm female, there is a huge body of chick lit and romance books that authors and production houses seek female British voices for. So in this country, I am in a different pond from the majority of American narrators. If I were in England, it would be the other way around. But so I have done a lot of romance, and some of them are quite steamy. Not so much the earlier romance novels, but the more contemporary ones, 50 Shades of Blue, Green, Yellow, Grey, and so forth, and chick lit books. But to be honest, the murder mystery, the thriller genre is what I like to listen to when I listen to books on tape myself, and what I also like to read. So it's a treat to be asked to narrate a book that I would want to read.
Which is great. And I was stunned. I heard at a recent conference called Crime Fest in Bristol, I went to an audiobook session, and the producer said there are very few books where the balance of characters in the crime thriller niche are female. So the roles for female narrators in crime thriller is a much smaller niche. So, and you're saying the same thing, right?
Yes. I think it will change as people listen to more audiobooks, because there's a suspension of disbelief, which is the same in theatre. It's the same in a movie. You know that I'm a woman. I don't need to tweak my voice technically to make it sound like I'm a man. The audience, after a few minutes, becomes tuned in, and then it's the skill of the narrator to indicate by a change in the pitch or a change in the tone or the timbre or whatever that I'm now a man. I think that will open up the field a little bit more and more people become used to listening to audiobooks and accept that suspension of disbelief. And hopefully that will translate into more authors saying, just because the protagonist is a male doesn't mean that a female can't read that story where appropriate.
Yeah, or that we have more crime thrillers with female protagonists.
Let's hope, because let's face it, ladies, we're doing just as much as the men are in every part of the world. So yeah. what do they call it, the glass ceiling. Mm. And it certainly is the same in showbiz as any other business. So yeah, let's break through. Let's do more women protagonists in the thriller genre.
Yeah, well, I'm pushing it myself. So, and I think I'm really just fascinated with this collaborative creativity, you know, with you and with Veronica and with my translators, because, you know, the authors are so obsessed with the concept of voice, of, you know, of the reader getting the voice of the author. But of course, they're judging the book twice when they're listening. They're judging my voice and they're also judging your voice. And the fact is, some people won't like my voice as an author. Some people won't like your voice as a reader. And then it's like a double jeopardy.
Yes, yes. Well, we're really laying ourselves out there, aren't we? We're both of us putting ourselves out to be slashed down at the knees. And of course, with the star rating system that's currently on Audible, everybody thinks they could read it better than me, and everybody thinks they can write it better than you. So,
oh, hell yeah. Well, I should say we've got really good reviews. So,
yay. Yes, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Mm. Because we're asking people to enjoy two things at once, and probably more. Mm. Because with the audiobooks, there's also the quality of the actual sound. What is this thing recorded in? What's it recorded on? What's it recorded with? Mm. What is the quality of the microphone? The quality of the ambiance that I'm recording in? If I'm recording in my bathroom, it's going to be a very different sound quality from recording in my studio, in my booth. Mm. So we're asking a lot of the listener, and we're putting ourselves out there creatively. So I guess that's showbiz, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's fun. It is a whole new world. And so I'm really excited. You're excited. Life is good. Where can people find you and your audiobooks and your work online?
Well, I have a website, rosalindashford.com. If you search through iTunes or audible.com or amazon.com, search Rosalind Ashford, my books will pop up.
Fantastic. And Desecration is available now, so people can check that out, and I'll put all the links in the show notes. So thanks again for your time, Rosalind. That was brilliant.
Thank you, Joanna. It's a pleasure to talk face-to-face with you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.